I'm Marcus Smith, and this is Constant Wonder. Do you ever think of yourself as living in a surveillance society? You know, there was a time when we reserved that lingo to describe, the state of affairs in totalitarian countries. But then London camera'd up in a big way in the age of terrorism, and other big cities too, and nowadays it isn't even so much that we're surveilled by governments and institutions. It could just be your neighbor. You know, cameras on the front porch or fence line, security cameras, or maybe something as benign, I guess mostly benign, as a YouTuber or an Instagrammer shooting strangers out in public with an iPhone. Who knows where your picture will turn up. But let's now widen this conversation out to other candidates for cameras, for candid cameras, shall we say, to borrow the phrase from television of years gone by. There has been a surge in the use of cameras to capture unsuspecting animals. Here to tell us more about it is Roland Kays, a zoologist and expert in using new technologies to study animals that are free-ranging. Roland Kays is a research associate professor in the North Carolina State University College of Natural Resources. He's head of the Biodiversity Lab and a host also of a podcast called Wild Animals, wherever you get your podcasts. Roland Kays is author of the book Candid Creatures, How Camera Traps Reveal the Mysteries of Nature. Roland Kays, welcome to our show.
Great. Thanks for having me.
So the word trap, that's kind of a weird word. I don't know who coined that terminology, but do you think of them as traps?
Well, they're traps in that they capture a photograph of an animal. And for me, you know, the traditional way, and I still do this sometimes, you know, we study wild animals is you go out, you set a trap, and you come back and you see if the animal's inside the trap. And this is the same kind of thing, but obviously you're not actually putting your hands on the animal, you're just capturing an image. So from a science point of view, I don't know, I just always call them camera traps. Some people call them trail cameras or game cameras. It's basically a motion-sensitive camera.
Yeah. Now, give us just a little bit of the history, the background for all of this, because I would imagine that as soon as the camera was invented, people were trying to take images of animals.
In fact, they were. And they weren't very good at it because, you know, early cameras had terrible flashes and were super big and their lenses weren't very good and the animals wouldn't let you get very close. So actually, some of the very first wildlife, like good wildlife pictures, the first wildlife pictures that were actually in National Geographic magazine were captured by a camera trap, stick the camera out there and put a string on the trigger and then go away. And people were so amazed at the candid and close-up pictures of these animals that were so shy, because back sort of early 1900s, things like deer weren't even very common. And so there was really a love affair for camera traps right from the beginning. And as you can imagine, as cameras have evolved in their technology since those olden days of magnesium powder cakes for flashes, the camera trap has as well.
When did you first get involved using them? Was this the kind of thing that tickled your fancy before you were a grown-up?
Well, they weren't really. I guess it dates myself a little bit. I didn't really become aware of them until I started a project in 2000 in the Adirondacks of New York. And we wanted to do a non-invasive survey of animals. So we wanted to do, survey the animals without capturing them in traps, actually. And so we used camera traps. And we also looked for footprints. We did a couple different things. We looked for scat. But the camera traps, I was really excited about. And at that point in time, it was a roll of 36 exposure film that you put in there. So you had 36 shots, and then it was done. You changed the film, and then you would take them back and take them into the shop, and it would be a week or so before you get the pictures back. So that was the first time I used camera traps.
It must just be exciting when you are going to go back and review footage. We still call it footage, even if it's a digital device. It's kind of a weird thing. But you go back and review this, and you don't know if you've caught something necessarily, or do you always know if you caught something?
You usually catch something, yeah. And in some ways, I kind of liken it to fishing, because, sometimes you get skunked, but usually you get something, and usually at least you have, in North Carolina, a few gray squirrels, a few deer. So those are kind of like the panfish, the little bluegills that you might catch if you're out fishing. But there's always a chance that you're going to get the big one. So that's kind of why it's always fun to see, what's the next picture? What came next? What came next? Because, you always might get, a mountain lion, or for me, I get excited about seeing coyotes, or, something weird, a black coyote or a predator chasing a prey. there's always that chance for some kind of really cool, unusual, or just something that you would never see with your own eyes.
So which types of animals are the most likely to show up?
Well, so for the one thing, with most of the cameras that we use these days, they only really trigger on warm-blooded animals. So birds and mammals, you get. Things like reptiles, you have to set them in very special ways to get snakes and lizards and turtles and things like that. So we're talking birds and mammals, and then generally, I sort of think of them as getting the larger things that are like chipmunk size and up. The smaller things, again, if you set them in very particular ways, you can get the smaller things. So basically, we're talking medium and large size mammals that are running around the ground. You can also, you can adapt. You can put them up in the trees and see what's running around up there. There's some great footage of monkeys and kinkajous and other animals down in the tropics. But generally, in North America, we're talking about sort of mammals and some terrestrial birds like grouse and pheasants and turkeys that are sort of, 100 grams, chipmunk size or larger.
How many different mechanisms have people come up with to trigger the capture of the images? It's not all just motion sensing, is it?
Well, it's trying to get motion in one sense or the other. The way that most people use it is called a passive infrared sensor, and that's just looking for changes in the heat signature of whatever's in front. So if a warm-blooded animal walks through, it'll trigger. The problem is, if a leaf heats up in the sunshine and starts blowing around, it'll also trigger. The other common one is something like, I kind of call it a break beam sensor. It's like, imagine kind of a laser beam shooting across, and if you break that laser beam, then it triggers. So that's the other common way. People have done, tie a string to a chicken leg or pressure pads. People have tried all sorts of different things.
Let's get into the title of your book, Candid Creatures, because I think this gets at the real crux of what you're trying to do methodologically. You're trying, it seems to me, to observe, to monitor, without intervening in what the animal would do otherwise. You're trying to be the proverbial fly on the wall, right?
Yeah, exactly. And, from a scientific point of view, this is what we really want is we want something that's representative of the world, right? We don't want we just want to know whatever's happening out there, right? If I put a camera out there and I get one squirrel in a month, that's still interesting to me. I mean, it's a little more boring looking at the pictures, but it still is information about what's going on at that place at that time. And so camera traps are great because they're very, non-invasive. I mean, animals notice them. It's a piece of plastic on the tree that wasn't there last time, but generally they're not afraid of them. And typically we use these infrared flashes. So if an animal goes by at night, they might see a little glow, but they don't get blinded by a white flash that would scare them away. So yeah, that's the goal, is let's just see what animals walk by this place in a month or a year or whatever.
So I hear stories about ravens and crows being really intelligent creatures. I'm wondering what other kinds of creatures might have the smarts to subvert your efforts, or make it off with a camera, for instance, that kind of a thing.
Yeah, there are a select group of creatures around the world that are sort of notorious amongst camera trappers for causing problems. The one that I had the most problem with here is black bears. They will just go up and start chewing on it for, I don't know why, but I've had a number of cameras destroyed by black bears. Elephants sometimes get a little rowdy with cameras and will stomp on them. I've had hyenas take my cameras in Africa. So there are some species who, jaguars have chewed on them. Sometimes we usually lock the cameras, and sometimes coyotes will grab the lock almost like a chew toy and just kind of play with it, which is kind of funny, but then usually your camera ends up like pointed at the sky, and so you get kind of annoyed.
I would think so. Why does there seem to be, and maybe I'm wrong about this, but there seems to be a preponderance of night shots, nocturnal animals?
Well, I think that's telling you about when most mammals are out and about, especially if it's an area that has a lot of people. One of the interesting things we've seen from camera traps is the same species near people will be way more nocturnal, and then during, someplace out in the wild, they might be active much more during the day. Black bears are a classic example like that. You do a survey out in the wilderness, and you see they're quite active during the day. You do a survey in areas that have a lot more people around, and they're much more active at night. So in some cases, the animals are just switching. And in other cases, there's just things like raccoons and possums that don't really come out during the daytime. And so you don't even know. Like in my backyard, if I put a camera out, I get a gray fox all the time. I've never seen one with my own eyes in my own backyard because they only come out at night and they're pretty shy.
Ah, that's going to come as a surprise to a lot of people if they knew what was crawling around at night right adjacent to their homes.
Totally. Yeah, it's really fun to see what's out there that, again, you know, you might hear some weird noises at night, but usually you don't know what it is, and a camera will get you a good image of that.
Have you met non-scientists who use this technique just out of curiosity to see what's lurking?
Sure. Well, I mean, the most common is hunters that are using them to scout for the hunting season. So they want to know which species and often, you know, which individuals. Maybe they want to go after the trophy buck. Where does he hang out? What time of day does he go by there so they can scout and prepare for the hunting season? So that is a very common use of camera traps. And then otherwise, yeah, this is totally, you know, some people are kind of doing the backyard thing. Other people get really into it, you know, make life lists, try to get as many different species as they can get, and just kind of have fun with it.
We're going to be talking about man-made structures that are designed to facilitate the movement of animals and how the cameras then fit into that whole story. But before we get there, there's a lot of felines, a lot of images of jaguars and leopards and tigers. And is this because this is a surveillance tool that's just safer when those big cats come? You don't want to be too close, I'm guessing.
Well, you know, big cats have definitely been a focus of camera trappers for a long time. Because that's another one of those groups of species that is just almost impossible to see with your own eyes. We did a project in Mount Kenya where we were up and down the trail 1,000 times and we never saw a leopard, and our cameras got tons of them. They're so good at avoiding people. But they're also a group that we're very concerned about, right? Tigers and African lions, and you know, a number of these species are endangered. The snow leopard's super endangered, but like snow leopard is just mythically difficult to actually lay your eyes on. And so these cameras, people realized early on that, wow, these are really the only way we can get good data on these species. And the other nice thing about some of these cats, like jaguars or leopards or tigers, is they have unique spot or stripe patterns. So we can actually recognize individuals in a much better way than you could with, say, a deer or a squirrel that all kind of look alike. So that opens up a whole other world of ways that you could use the data to track actually individual animals.
We're going to talk about those structures I mentioned. For example, highways, the underpasses, the overpasses. I've got one or two not many miles from where I live, actually. But there are also these things called gliding poles. I'm going to want to talk about that. We have with us Roland Kays, and he is author of Candid Creatures, How Camera Traps Reveal the Mysteries of Nature. You never feel guilty, do you, Roland, spying on these animals?
No, I really don't, because I've seen them, you know, just do everything right in front of the camera, and I realize they really don't care that the camera's there. So it's a great window into nature.
Well, okay. There has been an effort as of, going back maybe a decade or more, to facilitate the movement of particularly migratory animals. And so maybe about 40 miles from where I'm sitting right now, there is a bridge that was constructed over a multiple-lane highway. And then within just like the first year, they saw massive amounts of animal movement over this new corridor. It saves the lives of the animals and such. How much can you tell us about what cameras do to either validate those efforts or to justify the funds spent on them, that sort of thing?
Yeah, no, cameras have been really critical for finding ways to be strategic about helping animals get across the road. Because, you know, roads, anyone who drives the road sees the roadkill. So you know that you know, there's a lot of animals that are getting hit. It's an important cause of mortality, but it's also a problem in terms of fragmenting populations, and it sort of restricts animals from moving. So you get the migratory animals, like you said, but it can also just cause barriers for the normal dispersal of residential animals as well. If all of a sudden there's a highway through the middle of their home range, they can't get back and forth, they can't breed. And so, you know, roads are a big concern. Obviously, we're not going to get rid of roads. So the idea is, how do we make them more wildlife friendly? And cameras are critical for studying that. You know, there already are a lot of underpasses, typically, around roads. And so that's one of the questions is, you know, can animals, there's a river that goes under the roads. Do animals use the river to get under the road? You know, maybe there's a creek, maybe there's a seasonal creek. And so just evaluating these existing structures of different sizes and in different places, you know, which animals are using those, and then realizing, you know, sometimes that, okay, these migratory pronghorn are never going to go into that little tunnel or something like that, right? So, and here's the place where we really are having a problem, and that's where the motivation comes to build these larger, more expensive structures that go over the road, but are really needed for species that are not going to go through tunnels.
Would you explain gliding poles to us? I'd never heard of this.
Yeah, so there's, you know, some species, okay, this is in particular, the gliding poles are a fantastic example from for flying squirrels. There's a flying squirrel, the northern flying squirrel, that reaches its southern limits here in the mountains of North Carolina, and the Wildlife Commission was concerned about this road being a fragment and causing mortality or preventing them from getting over the road. And, of course, you know, flying squirrels can glide. And so what they did was they built basically just a telephone pole on the either side of the road with basically practically a diving board off the end of it. It was like it was like walk the plank kind of plank at the top. I mean, if you didn't know what it was, you would just look at it and have just no clue why the heck someone would put this basically 2x4 off the top of a telephone pole with nothing else attached to it. But the squirrels found it, and they put a camera there, and there's this amazing footage of this flying squirrel running down this plank and then just launching himself into blackness, right? Because it's night. That's the other crazy thing, is they're nocturnal. And so they do it, and they used it, and they use it to get right over the road, and they're on either side, and they can even land on the pole on the other side and then climb back up and keep going the other direction. So gliding poles are a fantastic example where biologists, you know, thought about the biology of this animal, worked with the animals, figured out ways for a, you know, relatively inexpensive mitigation measure to help them get across the road. Another fun one that folks use in the tropics are rope bridges to help monkeys get over roads. You know, they'll climb over vines and things like that, so they'll hang some ropes back and forth over a road, and the monkeys will climb right over the top.
Yeah. Well, Roland, you have done some fascinating observations, some surveillance of sloths. This turns up a fact that I guess nobody knew before about their sleep habits.
Yeah, so we were interested in studying sloths. This is getting a little away from the camera technology and into some other technology where you actually put, you know, units on animals to study them. And so we've done a bunch of animal tracking where you put a GPS on the animal and see where it goes. And I was working with some sleep biologists who were interested in how much do animals sleep. And this, you know, sleep is kind of a mysterious phenomenon, right? Why do we sleep? What good is it for us anyway? And one of the ways to study that is to compare across a bunch of different species. And the sloth was always an outlier in that comparison because it looked like they slept so much compared to their body size, way more than they should have. But people were like, well, it's a sloth, so maybe that makes sense. But it still seemed like it was just too much. But the way they had measured it was in a zoo. And so the animal's, you know, in a cage, and it's got wires running from its head to this machine to measure its sleep patterns. You have to, you know, to really know if an animal's sleeping and not just resting, you need to measure the brain waves. So we worked with some technology folks who were able to basically get this EEG machine to measure the brain waves into a small enough device that we could put it on the head of a sloth. And so we did that on a number of sloths, and we were able to measure their sleep patterns. And we found they actually sleep a lot less than we used to think they do, which fits, you know, kind of fits with the overall pattern that we find. And that was the first ever study of sleep in a wild animal.
Yeah, I'm just kind of thinking, and I'm not a scientist here, but I'm thinking if a sloth is going to go get some food, and if they move as slowly as they do, they're going to have some waking hours, and a lot of them.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. You know, people were like, oh, sloths are not as lazy as we think. They don't sleep as much as they think. But in some ways, they're even lazier because they're still not moving anymore. They're just awake for more of that time.
Yeah. Well, as long as we're talking about animal tracking, you've got a story about an animal that somebody decided to name Freedom. Tell us about Freedom.
Oh, yeah. Freedom the Eagle is a fantastic story about it. This is an animal from the North Carolina Raptor Center that was born to parents that were in their rehab center that couldn't fly. They had broken wings. But they still were able to breed, and so they had an offspring. They named the offspring Freedom. And once he got to be, you know, kind of getting older and ready to be able to learn how to fly, we went over and we attached a GPS device to him and so we could see what happened. And And then we left them there. And I went back to my office here in Raleigh, and every day I would check on the GPS data that would come in through the cell phone network. And I could see where they had him in this field, and they would bring him food, but he was free. But he didn't really know how to fly. So you could see him kind of hopping around the field, you know, maybe gliding between trees a little bit, but he's always going back to the food. So every day I would kind of look and see, okay, well, this is kind of boring. Then all of a sudden one day he was all the way up in West Virginia. He all of a sudden figured out how to fly and flew from Charlotte, North Carolina, up to West Virginia. And the next day he kept going up to Cleveland. He hung out on Lake Erie for a little while, went all the way up to Montreal, and then flew back down to North Carolina, South Carolina, Georgia. And he's been doing that loop ever since, migrating up and down throughout the region, really moving all over the place. So yeah. It's been really fun to follow Freedom. And you can follow him and other animals using an app called the Animal Tracker app that has a bunch of live tracking data from all sorts of different animals.
So is Freedom following a migratory behavior that one would expect of a bird in the wild that hadn't been sort of rescued and nurtured?
Yeah, he is more or less. And he was definitely hanging out with a lot of other bald eagles. People in Cleveland were taking on the lake there. I guess it's a known eagle hangout, and we were getting pictures sent to us of, you could see Freedom with his little backpack on, and then all the other eagles as well. Eagles take quite a long time to mature and actually start to breed, so he was still sort of doing the juvenile teenager wandering years kind of thing that's known for bald eagles.
At the Cleveland hangout.
That's right. Exactly. He's scoping out the ladies up there.
Well, Roland, I'm going to just do a little mind experiment game here with you. Suppose you're given buku bucks. You get great funding for an animal tracking project of your choice. Let's just say several thousand dollars, so you can do what you want. What animal are you going to go after? What would you track next? Where?
Well, I tell you, the phenomenon that I'm most interested in is what we call juvenile dispersal, which is when, you know, the teenagers take off and go find themselves a new home. And I think it's super interesting because the animals don't have a map, right? They don't know where they're going. All they know is, I can't stay home because mom or dad are getting grumpy with me or whatever. And so they have to just find their way. And this is a super important phenomenon because this is how, you know, if we think about the planet's changing, climate change, like maybe the new habitat that's right for this species is up north. So how do they get there through all the unsuitable habitat? And this is also, you know, how do they get over roads? How do they find where the overpasses or the underpasses are? And so I would love to do this with some animal that's expanding into new territory, you know, especially something like a wolf or a mountain lion where they're expanding their territory. It would be super interesting so that we can learn how these animals are moving through these landscapes that they don't know, and then likewise, then how can we make these landscapes easier for them to move through once we kind of understand what sort of decision rules they're using to get through there?
I can't resist this one. What's the most engaging footage you've seen with the most unexpected, surprising animal behavior of all the camera traps that you personally have set?
Yeah. Well, let's see. We got this really disgusting picture.
Maybe I shouldn't have asked.
Well, you asked. You opened the box here. I don't. Yes. This is radio, so I can just describe it.
Okay.
But it was a deer with this weird giant mass growing out of the side that was like the size of a dinner plate. And I just had no idea what the heck it was. And we talked to some veterinarians, and they said it's basically like a wart. And they're kind of known to have it. And probably it was fine, and probably eventually it fell off, and it probably wasn't a big deal. But that was one of just the weirdest things that I've ever seen on a picture. And luckily we were able to get a bit of an explanation for it.
Yeah, you know, this is so funny because 2 days ago, I kid you not, I was taking a morning walk before sunrise, and an hour before the sun came up. A deer was in our neighborhood. And it had this big old thing that was like, I can't even describe, I don't want to describe it to you, dangling from its neck. I thought, I know that a moose will have a dewlap, right? You know, the dangling.
Yeah.
And I finally decided that's got to be a tumor thing. But what you've told me gives me hope for that deer. I think
that just been a, yeah.
That growth is going to fall off eventually. And I'm just happy for the deer now.
Yeah. You know, I'll just mention one other thing that was super fun to see is a couple times we've gotten pictures of vampire bats stalking their mammal prey in the forest. And so you can see, like, we've had a video of a tapir, which is a very big animal from South America, kind of walking along. And then you can see the vampire bat running around the ground, running up to the tapir's ankle, trying to get some blood, and running back again. We've got another one of a vampire bat riding the back of a mountain lion through the tropics, sucking its blood. Those were also some pretty amazing pictures.
Bats run around on the ground?
Only vampire bats. Most bats are terrible at it. But, you know, if you're going to suck the blood of mammals, you got to be able to walk around on the ground and sneak up on them as well.
Wow. Well, Roland, a pleasure to meet you and to have the conversation with you today. Thank you so much for being with us.
Great. Well, thanks for having me.
Roland Kay is a zoologist with us. He's with the North Carolina State University College of Natural Resources, head of the Biodiversity Lab, North Carolina Museum of Natural Sciences, and author of the book Candid Creatures, How Camera Traps Reveal the Mysteries of Nature. You can also hear him on his podcast, Wild Animals. It's all good and fine for scientists to use technology to keep tabs on animals and their movement, you know, to better understand and help them. But many animals themselves seem to have some secret technology that rivals or exceeds what humans can offer. Still to come, natural super navigators, from whales to birds to butterflies, here on Constant Wonder. Thanks for listening to Constant Wonder. I'm Marcus Smith. Pigeons, puppies, turtles, bears, these all seem to know where they're going. How are they so good at finding their way, do you suppose? David Berry is the author of Super Navigators, Exploring the Wonders of How Animals Find Their Way. I want you to hear part of our conversation. We're going to dip in right where David Berry is commenting on his own navigational skills. I asked him, for instance, if he could get results using a sextant.
Yes, I can, and I'm completely besotted with celestial navigation. I was very lucky because when I was just 19, an old family friend invited me to help him sail his 34-foot wooden yacht across the Atlantic. And way back then, there was no GPS, and the only reliable way of navigating a small yacht on the open ocean was by the light of the sun and the stars. So he taught me to use a sextant. And I was entranced, and I remained so. And that was why I wrote the book Sextant.
You know, we could get into that in such a big way, but already you've touched on a theme of commonality, that celestial navigation thing that humans can do with a sextant. Apparently some animals have been doing that without sextants for years.
Exactly. You were quite right when you said there's a certain arrogance about our attitude towards our fellow creatures, because in truth, when it comes to navigation, we are not, most of us, really that great. And indeed, now that GPS has arrived, we're getting a lot worse. So the book I've just published, Super Navigators, is full of examples of animals that can do the most astonishing things. And some of those animals are extremely small.
How small, exactly?
Well, I mean, I start actually with bacteria. Single-celled organisms. Amazingly, there are bacteria that have built into them little magnets that act like a compass and enable the bacteria to steer towards the regions where they can best find nourishment. And there are lots and lots of insects that perform prodigies of navigation. I mean, long, long journeys, like, of course, the famous a monarch butterfly of North America, but there's a dragonfly that flies right across the Indian Ocean. There's a moth in Australia with the wonderful name of the bogong that does a two-way voyage by night of more than 1,000 kilometers, and that's turned out to have a magnetic compass sense, rather like the bacteria I mentioned, though it probably works in a different way.
I have just always thought of bacteria as creatures of happenstance. If they are plopped down in a certain place where there's food, like my compost pile, they're going to survive. But if they're plopped down in the hot sun on my concrete driveway, they're likely to die. They can actually get from here to there?
Yes, they have. They do indeed. They have little motors, and they have things called flagella, which are like appendages, whip-like appendages that they can wave around, which drive them along a bit like a propeller. And they actually do navigate. I mean, it's a very simple kind of navigation. It enables them to move towards the things they need, like food, and away from things they don't like too much heat or too much acidity. But yes, even such simple organisms as bacteria perform a kind of navigation.
Are you willing to call that intelligence?
Well, there's an interesting question. I think if you embrace the view that intelligence is on a spectrum, and at one end of it you have highly intelligent animals like, you know, primates, including human beings, and at the other end you have very simple organisms like bacteria, yeah, maybe you could call that a kind of intelligence. They don't appear to have any kind of, they don't have a nervous system. So if it is intelligence, it's of a different kind, but it certainly is possible for them to behave in ways that enable them to have a better chance of survival.
With this intelligence and that spectrum, you're not going to say that these germs, these bacteria, are self-reflective, having childish pride.
That would be a bit of a stretch. But, you know, there are people now who are beginning to talk about panpsychia, you know, that all things have some degree of consciousness. I'm not sure whether I buy that notion myself, but consciousness is a very, very tricky subject, and exactly who has it and who doesn't is open for some debate.
But getting from here to there requires, we can at least call it skill if it's not consciousness. Maybe this is something that is not, a self-reflective function on the part of the bacteria. But that in itself, it's amazing for a tiny creature to move away from what would be lethal heat or lethal acidity.
Yeah. But if you move a little bit further up the kind of evolutionary scale, so to speak, and you look at an animal like the desert ant of North Africa, which has been studied with enormous rigor over the last 50 years or so by an extraordinary German scientist called Rüdiger Wehner, whom I interviewed for Super Navigators, it turns out that this little ant, which is only half an inch long, has an elaborate navigational toolkit. So it has a compass sense that is based on patterns of polarized light in the sky. It can measure the distance it's walked by keeping track of the number of steps it's taken. It can use its sense of smell. It has a magnetic sense. It's capable of something that we actually find quite difficult, which is dead reckoning. It can work out where it is by plotting its course and measuring the distance it's gone, so that even after a long zigzagging journey over the hot desert sand, it knows exactly where it is in relation to the tiny entrance to its nest, and it can head straight back to it. Truly astonishing.
You know, other than my father's talking about sextants, the next thing he loved to talk about was dead reckoning. I'm kidding you not. This dead reckoning was something he loved to talk about. Did you ever have to do that on a boat?
Oh, all the time. It's an absolutely fundamental tool of navigation. Well, it used to be, of course, because with the advent of GPS, and this is a theme I keep coming back to in my writing, with the advent of GPS, our relationship with navigation has undergone the most profound revolution. I mean, for the first time in the history of the planet Earth, there is an organism that can get around and fix its position anywhere on the face of the planet without actually engaging its brain. You know, we just press a button and we know where we are and we know where to go to get somewhere. That is entirely new in the last 20 or 30 years.
I have a little device in my pocket called a smartphone, and it has an app on it that when I take my morning walks before sunrise, it will chart my course quite accurately. I can even see if I'm on the left-hand side of the street or the right-hand side, and some satellite is tracking that. And all the while, I'm very smug about this device in my pocket, oblivious to, say, the stars overhead, there's Venus or there's Jupiter or there's Polaris, and I'm not watching the stars anymore.
No, this is I think you've put your finger on the thing that concerns me most. There are all sorts of issues about our increasing reliance on GPS. You know, it's vulnerable. You know, batteries fail, the signal can be jammed, and so on. But the real issue for me is that as we become more and more dependent on it, we're becoming more and more distanced from the world around us. We no longer need to look around us to find out where we are. We no longer need to know about the stars and the movement of the sun across the sky. And I think it's a really fundamental change in our relationship with the natural world. And I don't think it's a very healthy one.
So if a humble dung beetle, for instance, is lacking a GPS, but is able to see stars and move according to the position of stars, I think that's the story. Isn't that right?
It is indeed correct. Some remarkable research revealed that the nocturnal dung beetles of South Africa, first of all, could navigate at night and maintain a straight course by the light of the moon. And then the scientists discovered, when they were doing a further experiment, and the moon hadn't yet risen, and they saw that dung beetles were managing to maintain a steady course without the light of the moon, they wondered what was going on, and they looked up at the night sky, and they saw the beautiful band of the Milky Way in this sky completely without light pollution over the desert. And they suddenly said, well, could it be? Is it possible that these dung beetles are steering by the light of the Milky Way? And sure enough, it turned out that the beetles were doing that. They did a wonderful experiment that involved putting little cardboard hats on the beetles to prevent them seeing the Milky Way, and they went all over the place. And then later they did a further experiment in a planetarium where they were able to manipulate the orientation of the Milky Way, and sure enough, they could make the beetles go off in different directions according to the orientation of the Milky Way. It's wonderful.
I actually had a chance on this show to interview the man who put little hats on dung beetles, and so I'm familiar with the story. I'm wondering if there is anything that we humans might be capable of doing in the way of navigation that might not be so cerebral, that might be a little bit more instinctive, the way a dung beetle operates. I guess I mean to say, are there things we can sense that we're not really processing intellectually?
That's a very interesting question. There's a scientist called Joe Kirschfink at Caltech who has recently done a series of experiments on human subjects which seem to suggest, contrary to most of the previous evidence, that human beings are in some degree sensitive to the surrounding magnetic field of the Earth, though not conscious of it. This experiment involved measuring changes in their brain waves while under the influence of an altered magnetic field. So the question does arise, are we perhaps able to use the Earth's magnetic field like so many other animals to navigate by, even though we don't know it? Well, I think the jury's out on this, and there's quite a lot of skepticism in the scientific world, but it's an interesting question. And it's certainly true that we are sensitive to lots of sensory inputs that don't rise to the level of our consciousness. Our sense of smell, for example, is extraordinarily important to us, and quite often it affects our behavior without our ever being aware of it.
So would you hazard to say that there might be vestigial remnants of functions that we once relied on that we perhaps have lost?
I think it's quite possible. But what is certainly true is that there are lots of indigenous peoples around the world who still practice traditional navigational techniques, which are quite astonishing in their effectiveness and their elaboration. So if you look at the Inuit peoples of the Canadian Arctic, if you look at Aboriginal tribes in the deserts of Australia, if you look at the Pacific Islanders, all of these indigenous groups developed, and in some cases are able still to maintain, amazing navigational skills that don't involve any instruments or any maps, let alone GPS. And these people can do stuff that the rest of us, well, we would just look on in complete astonishment.
Well, from things like sensing things in our with our olfactory sense, with the sense of smell, to the we've talked about seeing the stars, that kind of sensory experience. Infrasound is also something that you talk about as being a phenomenon that certain animals have mechanisms for picking that up.
That's absolutely right. Quite a lot of animals are sensitive to very, very low frequency sounds that we can't hear. And there's a very interesting theory that has been developed by a sort of one-man research team in the shape of John Hagstrom, who works for the U.S. Geological Survey. And John has developed a theory that homing pigeons may be able to use the, if you like, the infrasound signature of the locality where they live as a kind of beacon to home in on when they're returning from great distances. This is highly controversial because there isn't any solid direct evidence for it, but there's masses of very intriguing circumstantial evidence, and I'm hoping that one of these days it'll be possible to pin this down.
So the story that I'm imagining right now is that I'm a homing pigeon, and there are certain potentially sounds that I they resonate with me, literally and figuratively, as my home. And yeah. I'm far from home, and maybe I'm not thinking it through at all, but as a pigeon, I'm just saying, well, I'm going to be happier. It feels better if I go this way, because that kind of feels like home to me.
I think I find that entirely plausible. I mean, whether in fact it's infrasound or smell, because there is another theory that pigeons use their sense of smell to help them home from great distances. I mean, I should have explained that homing pigeons exhibit a really extraordinary capacity, which is you can take a homing pigeon maybe 300 kilometers away from its home roost to a place it's never been to before. You can even anesthetize it during the journey, so it has absolutely no idea where it's been taken. And you can release it in this novel location, and more often than not, they will find their way home. It's astounding. How could that possibly work? Well, there are lots and lots of theories. One of them is that somehow they use their sense of smell, and there's quite a lot of evidence to support that, though it's still not firmly settled. And then there's John Hagstrom's theory about infrasound, which might also be true. It may be that they use two mechanisms.
What thoughts have you given to the idea that humans have altered the environment so radically that we are providing impediments, the obstacles to this supernavigation of animals?
Well, I do talk about this in my book, Supernavigators, but it's a big and complicated subject. Unfortunately, there's masses of evidence that human activity is interfering with the navigational skills of a whole host of animals, whether it's marine turtles, migratory birds, insects, whales. We are constantly producing interference, whether it's light pollution. I mean, migratory birds and insects die in their millions because of the extraordinarily bright lights that we create, especially over our cities. The noises that we make in the ocean may well interfere with the ability of marine animals to navigate successfully. We know that marine turtles have great difficulty because at the point when they hatch from their eggs and they need to get down to the ocean, they rely on light because in the absence of artificial light, generally speaking, the horizon over the ocean is a bit brighter than the horizon over the land. So they head towards the light over the ocean to get into the sea and relative safety. But of course, now that there's so much light over the land, especially in populous areas like, for example, the state of Florida, they have great difficulty. And many, many of them go the wrong way and die as a result. I could go on and on. I mean, there are so many examples of the damaging effect of human activity on animal navigators.
So without getting into the nitty-gritty of the particulars of how we might remedy all of these situations, maybe addressing light pollution or dealing with other types of interferences that we're providing, sound being a big one, I understand at sea, the sound of ships and such, is there some general wisdom you have for how we humans should move forward with a little bit more graciousness towards these animals that we're really messing up their world in terms of navigation?
Well, it's a very good question, and I think one of the lessons that I drew from my researches was that we needed to be a great deal more humble, that we needed to get away from this notion that is deeply, deeply embedded in our culture, that human beings are, as it were, the top dogs, that we're the kind of pinnacle of creation. Yeah, sure, in lots of ways human beings are remarkable creatures, and there are things that we can do that no other animals can do. But at the same time, there are lots and lots of animals, even little insects like the desert ant, that can do stuff we can't do without the help of technology. And I think it's very, very important if we're to tackle many of the problems that we now face in the world today, that we get away from this notion that we have all the answers and that other animals are just there at our disposal and can be treated with no respect. Because if we go on that way, we're going to really wreck this planet, and that won't be good for any of us.
So this idea of humility being something we humans need, that I see quite clearly now, that informs your title, Super Navigators, when you're putting the spotlight on non-human animals who are able to get around. Those, I guess that means that your next book might be about, if it were about humans, it would be Midland Navigators or subpar navigators. That would be us.
Well, I, as a matter of fact, I think now that we've entered this new era of satellite navigation, I think the title of the book might be Idiot Navigators.
I don't even think that's going out on a very long limb. David Barry, such a pleasure to visit with you and to learn about your book and your experiences, your wisdom here. It's a pleasure to have you on our show.
It's been a delight. Thanks very much for inviting me.
David Barry, author of Super Navigators, Exploring the Wonders of How Animals Find Their Way. Let me give you a heads up as to where we're headed next. You see the navigational illusion there. There's a certain brilliant creature that knows how to get around. Not much respected, though. Rats. Not only are they terribly smart, they're very trainable, and if your job is to find landmines, they can be lifesavers. I got this story from Charlie Richter, director of the nonprofit Apopo U.S.
In areas where there's battle, there's often a lot of scrap metal, bullet casings, but also just metallic soil in many of the areas where we work. They have constant false alarms. So every time, you know, either a rat or a human with a metal detector indicates that there's a mine, they have to actually get down on the ground, a very slow excavation process. And with humans with metal detectors, a large percentage of the time, there's nothing there. So the process becomes very, very slow. And of course, expensive because you're paying that labor to often look at false alarms. But with rats, we cut that process out. They almost never give false alarms. They've also never missed a mine in the over 60 million square meters that we've searched. So they've been very effective, and we do constant quality control around them, and have never found them to once miss a mine.
So the rat is actually sniffing the ground and just moving through terrain, directed to go in a very systematic pattern to comprehensively cover a certain tract of land. But this is just sniffing.
Yeah, they're just sniffing. I mean, rats, like dogs, have a very good sense of smell. And through positive behavioral reinforcement training, you can get them to indicate very accurately on the smell of TNT, which we're doing here, which is what's found in most mines. And it's really a somewhat of a similar process to dogs. Dogs, though, work more for affection. Rats work for a food reward. And one other interesting fact between rats and dogs is dogs are bond forming. So they're working for the affection of one individual trainer they know well. Rats actually are just working for food. So they can be transferred between trainers much more easily, which is an advantage in the field.
Do you have to go to Africa to get them? Are they raised wherever you're doing the training? I mean, how are they brought up and how are they trained?
Basically, we have our own breeding and training center in Tanzania. The idea of Apopo and training rats was born in the mid-90s. And, through several research projects, exploration on what was the best species of rats to actually detect landmines, we landed on the African giant pouch rat. And over the years, we have created our own breeding pool, which contains offspring of rats that have been domesticated and used by us over almost two decades now. But also, we do, from time to time, to increase genetic diversity, actually find rats from the wild near our center and bring them in.
Do you have any concept at all as to when this job's going to be done? I mean, I hear these stories from year to year to year, and it just sounds like maybe as fast as we're finding them and disabling them, more are being put in places, and yet some of them extend way back for decades.
I mean, there is a big effort in the landmine community now to speed up landmine detection. You know, there's something called the Anti-Personnel Landmine Ban Convention that's operated under the UN, and many countries have signed that convention, and with signing that, you commit to demining your country within 10 years. Now, in reality, that very rarely happens, often due to a lack of funding, but often because many organizations are still reliant on humans with metal detectors, which, as I explained earlier, can be very slow.
Charlie Richter, he knows what's possible with Hero Rats in his position as director of the nonprofit Apopo US. Still to come, taking on the juggernaut of overly industrialized factory farms, an English farmer tries to preserve some of the old ways of farming. But how much of the old ways are really antiquated, and how many of the newer farming philosophies and practices are really all that wrongheaded? I'm Marcus Smith. You're listening to Constant Wonder.